You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome to Connecting the Dots.
I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today on this fine Tuesday afternoon, not only with Michael Litchens, my co-host.
Hello.
But also, we are here with my cough, which is going to be a consistent feature of this show, I think, from now until eternity. It's just me coughing from now until the end of time. But also, we are here. See, told you. With Jack Quirk. He is the founder and publisher of the online magazine Christian Democracy, which you can go and find at the creatively titled www.christiandemocracymagazine.com. Just go to the website or Google Christian Democracy Magazine. You'll go right there. And which the purpose of Christian Democracy is to attempt to look at contemporary affairs in light of Catholic social teaching. He's also a contributing editor for the Distributist Review, and he writes for the New Pro-Life Movement blog, and his was one of the articles featured in the book Radically Catholic in the Age of Francis, an anthology of visions for the future. It was put out by Solidarity Hall. So I want to welcome Jack Quirk. How you doing, man?
How you doing, Mark? And Michael, how you doing? I'm glad. At first there for a minute, I thought I was being identified as your cough, but I'm glad you explicated further. But
yes. So I live to clarify. So
yeah, that's right.
So when you say you've been involved in Catholic social teaching, you're one of the marks of somebody who's been spending some time thinking about Catholic social teaching as they pay attention to things like distributism and other quixotic struggles to live out Catholic
social.
Quixotic. Well, you know, I'm a fan of, I'm a huge Chesterton fan, and so I pay attention to things like distributism. And, you know, I'm one of these people that says, well, just because something is probably you know, doomed to always be a minority opinion doesn't mean that it's wrong. You know, when Jesus started, he only had 12 disciples. So, and things weren't promising for taking over the world at that point. But, you know, a billion disciples later, you never know how things are going to turn out. Talk about the Distributist Review a little bit.
Well, the Distributist Review, I was not involved with its founding at all. And I was just simply asked to write for it, but distributism, as I understand it, is that capital ownership should be spread as widely as possible. That's a view I've had since before I knew it was called distributism, and right. Was happy to find out that it was in accord with Catholic social teaching. My belief about it is that it is a legitimate expression of what Catholic social teaching calls for. And perhaps if we're ever to be fully put into practice, maybe the only way that's been thought of to do it. However, I would make it a subset of Catholic social teaching, certainly the most predominant one, at least that you find in internet circles, and certainly the most systematized or clearly thought out. Systematized, I say that with a grain of salt, because distributism is certainly not that. But it embodies a very good expression of what was contained in Rerum Novarum, social encyclical of Leo XIII that gave birth to all of this.
That Western economics has successfully beaten off for a century.
Right.
Well, Chesterton's argument against capitalism was that the problem with capitalism is that there are too few capitalists.
Exactly right. That's exactly.
It, you know, it, it, politically we got in the United States, we figured out right at the beginning that you don't want too much political power concentrated in too few hands. So we set up a whole system of checks and balances to make sure that nobody got too much power. But what we never seemed to grasp was that you also don't want too much economic power concentrated in too few hands, because the same bad things will happen.
Yeah. Well, that's been grasped in the past, hence the antitrust laws.
Sure.
The influence of Teddy Roosevelt and so on. Alas, we've not been altogether successful in keeping that at bay as present circumstances make
right. Yeah, I mean, Roosevelt's party is the one that's doing everything possible now to destroy Roosevelt's legacy.
And Lincoln's legacy. I mean, and Eisenhower's legacy, for that matter, and actually Nixon established the EPA. So I mean, there's been a
They really are trying to dynamite everything that the GOP did good. You know,
But Nixon can be blamed. I mean, it was his Southern strategy that brought some of the old Dixiecrats over. What we call neoconservatives used to be, well, they're Wilsonian Democrats, so they came over. There's been a lot
and
of
a few Trotskyists. Let's not forget those guys.
Yeah. A few guys that just learned a lot from Trotsky, and it's weird. One of the things that. I'd like to get to talking about Christian Democracy magazine, but one of the things that also we mentioned earlier was that you have written for the New Pro-Life Movement blog, which is doing good things, I think, that we need a new pro-life movement. The old pro-life movement has effectively become a movement of people who use the unborn as human shields for all the really terrible things that the party of Trump is doing now.
Well, we need I agree that we need a pro-life movement that is politically independent. I mean, there's nothing wrong with political involvement, because ultimately social policy does entail politics. But when you become so subservient to one of the political parties that you it wind up endorsing whatever they do, as long as they say that they're against abortion, well, you're going to wind up really undermining your entire movement.
The pro-life movement, as far as I'm concerned, has become sort of the organ grinder monkey for the GOP. I mean, it's just whatever, you know, the GOP comes out with. Trump announces that, you know, on the basis of nothing, Obama is wiretapping him. And it's the pro-life movement is like, we have to investigate this. Why are we wasting our time with this dumb, baseless thing? You know,
I concur with you. They have become absorbed by the partisanship of the time,
right?
And it's just it undermines everything that we and I say we, because I'm pro-life. I consider myself part of the pro-life movement.
Of course.
But that entails a wide range of things. And at some point I had to ask myself, you know, how pro-life is it to cut food stamps? Pro-life is it to, you know, drone Middle Eastern villages? I mean, these are the contradictions that emerge and actually undermine the credibility of what we're really standing for.
Right. Yeah. You know, battling the church for the death penalty, battling the church to make sure that poor people remain below the poverty line, fighting the church in order to struggle as pro-lifers did for 10 years, struggled to rationalize and justify the use of torture.
It's common all the way around for people to believe that they know better than the church. And so it's been for a long time that seemed to be more evident on the liberal side with things like abortion and birth control. Right. But in recent memory, we've come to see that there is a quote unquote conservative aspect to this, particularly in economic areas.
There's a website called canon212.com. That's one of these websites that's devoted to, we hate the Pope and, we'll, you know, attack him at every turn. And, you know, their website today had, you know, the standard, we hate the Pope story for the day. And then below it was a picture of Donald Trump wearing a halo.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's everything wrong with conservative pro-life Catholicism right now.
I agree with you. I agree with you. And I put quotes around conservatism, I put quotes around conservative because I consider myself conservative in many respects, and I consider myself Catholic and pro-life. So, but yeah. what these people are doing is entirely contrary to anything that I have ever thought of in connection with those terms.
Right. Yeah. I mean, my opinion was always that conservatism should conserve something.
Well, yes. And conservatism nowadays actually turns out to be a kind of nihilism. Okay.
Yeah.
In other words, we're going to lower taxes to the point where the federal government is small enough to be drowned in a bathtub, type of language. I mean, that's nihilism. That's not conservatism.
Right. And it's crazy. I mean, you know, we're talking about the biggest technological civilization on the face of the earth. And there's this bizarre notion that we can live with a state mechanism that looks exactly the way it did in 1796. Right. This is not going to happen, you know. Well, we're up against a break, but when we return, we're going to continue chatting with Michael Litchens and Mr. Jack Quirk from Christian Democracy Magazine, and we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
To Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Michael Litchens and Mr. Jack Quirk of Christian Democracy Magazine. If you want to join the conversation, please direct all praise to Michael Litchens, all complaints to me. Give us a call at 1-573-4-BREAD, 415-734-BREAD-4. Before we went to the break, you were going to say something, but I cut you off because I was being my voluble self.
Oh, it happens, Mark.
Okay.
But something I wanted to point out, and I'd love to hear both of your comments, actually, both Jack and Mark's here. I notice, like, in pro-life work, and I mean, I talk to a lot of women, and I help with a lot of folks who are helping women who are in crisis pregnancy with adoption, things like that, that there seems to be a complete dichotomy about what you hear on the ground in the pro-life movement, you know, the local stuff, the things I would be doing here in Denver or the Denver metro area versus what the leadership is doing, to a point where I sometimes wonder if the two are even talking anymore. Have you guys noticed that too recently?
I don't know that I have. I spend a lot of time paying attention to what the leadership says.
Sure.
And, when it comes to individual pro-life people on the ground, well, you know, yeah, it's going to be any number of approaches. People that are actually working with women are obviously going to have a different view of it than people who are just thinking about it in the abstract.
Sure.
And when you think about it in the abstract, without actually dealing with the flesh and blood individuals that are involved with these things, you can reach some fairly erroneous conclusions, such as that there is no economic component to the abortion question.
Mm.
That's just flat wrong. I mean, economics is a primary motivator in the abortion decision. What few people seem to recognize is that a woman killing her own child even in the womb, is the single most unnatural act ever that ever developed. And so there has to be something coming from the outside to make that happen. And the economic circumstances that we confront, to wit, women who find themselves abandoned without any help, without any health care, without any hope of being able to sustain themselves after they give birth or to sustain the child, are being pushed toward the abortion question. And of course, without the benefit of Catholic teaching and the belief that they're actually taking a life, they might, in a nonverbal sense, understand that, which is what makes the decision difficult in the first place. But without that teaching that drives them, they're going to be driven to abortion if you give them enough encouragement. And our society gives them plenty of encouragement.
Unfortunately, yeah.
Tremendous pressure. And that's, you know, that's what I've been saying for a good long while now, is that unfortunately the pro-life movement has entirely hitched its hopes to one single strategy, and that is reducing supply of abortion. So the big magic thing that's going to happen come the millennium is we're gonna overturn Roe v. Wade. And so everything, every election always is about we have to nominate the guy who's gonna put, you know, pro-life judges on the Supreme Court, because magically someday for sure the court is gonna look at Roe v. Wade and they're gonna overturn it.
Well, let's imagine that happens. Well, the fact is Roe versus Wade did not legalize abortion throughout the United States.
Right. It was already legal in Washington.
It was already legal in some places. Right. So the point is that even if you overturn Roe versus Wade, that's not going to end abortion in the United States. I would suspect that the states that would outlaw abortion completely would be relatively few. Abortions in California will continue apace. And if, say, in South Dakota, they make it out, they outlaw it, well, then women will just go to California to get their abortions.
You just go to Illinois, you know.
Yeah, the strategy is completely bankrupt. And by limiting the supply, all you're eliminating is the licensed medical professionals that will do it openly. Okay,
right.
Abortion has been with us for centuries. It existed in New Testament times. You have to have policies that eliminate the incentive. And, you know, the other thing you have to do is evangelize. One very bad way to evangelize, of course, is to say it's okay to carpet bomb Middle Eastern villagers. And then, so,
people get the distinct impression you don't really give that much of a rip about human life. You know?
Right. Yes, exactly. So, I mean, evangelize as to Catholicism, you have to represent all of Catholicism. And if you let a political party, whether it be the GOP or the Democratic Party, overwhelm the Christian message, well, then that's not the Christian message anymore, is it?
Right. Right. And what strikes me with all of this, the poisonous thing that goes with this has been the tribalization of our politics, so that we don't measure ideas by whether or not they're true, whether or not they comport with Catholic social teaching. The way we measure them is by things like, that sounds liberal.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like something that Hillary would say.
Right.
That sounds like something that Obama would say. And so when somebody says things like, you know, perhaps if we had affordable health care, well, the bells go off as soon as you say affordable health care. That's something a liberal would say.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you had affordable health care, then people wouldn't be doing things like going to get abortions as much, because they would be able to, afford to take care of their families. Or if you had a minimum wage where people made a living wage, they wouldn't be thinking, I have to kill this next kid because we've already got four.
If women knew that they and the child that they were giving birth to would have all that they needed in terms of the food, shelter, clothing, education, and medical care, that they were going to have all their needs met. If they knew that, then I submit that beyond a reasonable doubt that the number of abortions in this country would be reduced substantially.
But see, that would lead to spiritual, that would lead to spiritual softness if you do those kinds of things. People will just become, they'll become socialists, and then they'll just lose their will to live. You know,
well,
live off the state.
And, and I have to be the crank here and ask you.
That sounds Darwinian to me, but anyway.
Oh, I was just saying, and I have to be the crank here and wonder, are there real life examples where abortion rates have gone down with social services at, offered at all?
Well, you know, the funny thing is that social
under Obama,
abortions have been going down consistently since the 1990s, regardless of who's been in power. So
Was an uptick under Bush.
That's true.
It dropped dramatically under Clinton. There was an uptick under Bush, and then it dropped to its lowest point in history since Roe under Obama, under the great Satan.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there you have it. I mean, and if I'm not mistaken, that uptick occurred when he had at least a Republican Senate. I'd have to research that. But yes, there is. But the downward trend, but for that uptick that you mentioned, has been continuous since the 1990s.
Yeah. So it's a lot of it's just common sense. Why do women get abortions? Well, they get them for fun because they're evil. You know, that's not why. Why do people do it? They do it because they're desperate.
That's kind of a Calvinist understanding, isn't it? You know, total depravity. People are doing this. People are doing this just because of their innate evil.
Oh, that's totally depraved.
That's Calvinism, and here we have another example of how American Catholicism is being co-opted by a Protestant worldview. Right? You see, I mean, in other words, it's just the evil that's causing it. Not there's no reason or to look to any causal factors beyond that, and that of course. Results in policy recommendations that are basically bankrupt.
Right. So, you know, one of the things that the pro-life movement really has to do that it's barely considered is looking at demand. It's looked entirely at supply. All we got to do is just cut off supply, and then we'll have done our thing. We'll have told women you can't have abortions, and we have thereby discharged our entire moral obligation to this issue.
Well, see, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So that's it. You know, no, you haven't. You know, what all you've done really, and the policies that the same people who are opposed to abortion consistently uphold are policies that drive up the abortion rate. And I'm perfectly certain that what we're going to see under Trump will be an uptick in the abortion rate.
We shall see. But, you know, this is you've got 1 minute to the break here. But it seems to me that this is an effort. Sometimes I'll leave it to this before the break. Sometimes teams are criticized for playing not to lose rather than to win. And I think that exemplifies the kind of approach that the pro-life movement has been taking, or some people take to the pro-life issue when it comes to advocating on social policy. And I think a lot of people are trying to assuage their conscience when it comes to their political action. And when it comes to politics, they're not trying to do something good. They're trying to avoid themselves going to hell.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. We're up against a break right now, but we'll be right back after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with my co-host, Mr. Michael Litchens, and our special guest, Jack Quirk of Christian Democracy Magazine. And we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast.
Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Welcome back to Connect Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Mr. Michael Litchens and also with Jack Quirk of Christian Democracy Magazine. I have to interrupt with an important bulletin. Crucial news has just come in over the wires. Stop the presses. Jason Isaacs, the guy who played Lucius Malfoy, has been cast as the next captain of a starship in Star Trek Discovery. I think this is super important. We could probably spend the rest of the show talking about that, but you know, we'll press on.
You learn something every day. I didn't know there was a new one coming up, so there you go.
Yes. Lucius Malfoy is now going to be an important addition to the United Federation of Planets. So that
I'm a dinosaur. I think they never improved upon the original, but hey.
Well, there you go. I'm a Deep Space Nine fan, but I hear you.
Yes.
I have a high respect for Spock. But okay, we fulfilled our nerd quotient for this episode. Connecting the dots. I wanted to talk a little bit about the essay that you wrote for Radically Catholic in the Age of Francis. I presume, of course, that like all good Catholics, your essay was about what we as Catholics can do to protect ourselves from the most evil pope who has ever lived in the history of the church. Am I characterizing your essay right? Or
No, that wasn't anything.
Okay.
it was a... what we were asked for in writing those was kind of a statement of our personal journey. And so I said, okay, fine, I'll afflict you with that. And I did, and talked about myself for however long I went in terms of describing what my journey was and coming to an understanding of Catholic social teaching and actually making myself talk about it and be involved with it. And so it started out back in the days when I was a political agnostic, mm-hmm. and suddenly radicalized by George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq, mm-hmm. and got myself interested in that and started to look at things from various perspectives. And that from there, I began to take an interest in Catholic social teaching and just basically told the story from there, all the things I went through, and tried to describe it in a lighthearted and humorous fashion, hopefully succeeded enough. Well, I succeeded enough for them to print it, but hopefully it was of some entertainment value to the readers.
Okay.
That was what it was about. The only time that my biography has ever become interesting, but there it was.
Well, I think it sounds very similar to my own experience. I've always considered myself a conservative, but I was a Chestertonian. And so I'm one of those conservatives that prioritized the teaching of the church over whatever some dumb human party happened to think.
Right.
And I sort of assumed that those two goals generally lined up, that we were both about conserving things. So, you know, we'll probably wind up at the same page. But it turned out that I was dramatically wrong. And it was very difficult to be a Chestertonian and look at the Iraq War and say, this somehow comports with Catholic teaching. I've got two bishops, two popes and all the bishops of the world all saying, this does not in any way meet just war criteria.
Right. Well, you know, that's exactly what my experience was. There was a publication that I was subscribing to at the time because it seemed to me that they were advocating things that I was for in terms of, you know, the more pelvic issues, obviously, and also a certain reverence and worship And so I liked it, and so I subscribed to the magazine. Then I discovered, opened it up 1 month and discovered that they were trying to justify the invasion of Iraq and were even suggesting that the just war doctrine be revisited. And I thought to myself, well, now, wait a minute, what happened to Orthodox Catholicism?
Right.
And so that was a real eye opener. And so, we had similar experiences in that respect.
You know, what's funny is Benedict suggested also that just war doctrine might need to be revisited. But Benedict's idea, of course, was that maybe there's no place left for just war doctrine.
Which maybe is a debate theologians have been having since at least the 70s, if not longer.
Right, you know, but it was like, okay, this is not going in the direction that, First Things or Crisis were
Well, with the types of weapons that would have been developed since the just war doctrine was first enunciated, that's a rational thing to say. I mean, because when they first talked about the just war doctrine, people were stabbing and throwing things at each other. They weren't flying from the sky and leveling whole villages.
Yes, or whole cities.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm watching this administration, multiple times asking, why can't we use nuclear weapons? And I'm thinking, this is going the wrong direction. And simply that, I remember listening to Catholics saying that when Benedict said that preemptive war is not in the catechism, I actually heard Catholics seriously attempt to make the case that because preemptive war is not in the catechism, that means the church does not address preemptive war, and therefore preemptive war is okay.
Well, that's a similar type of discussion with regard to, have you ever heard of the Acton Institute? I came across an article by the some time ago. You remember when Scott Walker was trying to basically neuter the public employee unions. And so Father Sirico, the president of that organization, wrote an article that appeared in the Chicago newspaper and elsewhere, basically saying, if you look at Catholic social teaching, it never says anything, even though it supports the rights of workers to organize. It never specifically mentions public employee unions. So therefore, we can take a stand with Scott Walker against collective bargaining.
Argument was also used with attempts to rationalize torture. Unless the church specifically defines some specific act as torture, that means it's not torture. Which, a friend of mine said, the church has never formally defined that suction aspiration is a form of abortion. So we just don't know if it's oral or not. Who knows? It's all just so baffling, And that kind of incredibly dishonest lying that I've seen repeatedly from what I can only now call the dissenting right, which is just as much a dissenting movement as the dissenting left, has been. I've watched this habit of mind, and that's what it is. It's a cast of mind that approaches the church's teaching with what I call minimum daily adult requirement Catholicism. What's the absolute bare minimum that I can get away in terms of obedience, and anything else I will rationalize cleverly.
American phenomenon.
that kind of lawyerliness, But it's when we're talking about issues of life and death, it's not complicated. The church says unless you absolutely have to kill somebody, don't do it.
Right,
and that's it. So preemptive war. Why is preemptive war wrong? Because unless you absolutely have to kill somebody, don't do it. And preemptive war hasn't made that case at all.
Right. Because preemptive war by definition means that you don't absolutely have to do it.
Right.
I mean, when it's when it comes to reducing Catholic social teaching to, you know, one or two axioms, one thing that needs to first be recognized is that each individual human being is of infinite worth. There is no such thing as an acceptable casualty in Catholic teaching.
Yeah.
And so when you're about to do something that's going to hurt somebody in a significant way, there's no justification for it unless it is to avert a more significant evil. And even then, that is the cautionary to that is that you cannot do evil so that good may come from it.
Right.
So that, right. You know, and so when you, whether it's abortion or whether it's cutting food stamps or whether it's preemptive war or capital punishment or any of the other issues that come up,
yeah,
each individual is to be viewed as of infinite worth and an end in himself or herself. And that, and if we're not doing that, we're straying from the mark.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. And you know, I keep thinking, I'd love to be able to get away from questions of life and death into something, you know, just having to constantly say you shouldn't kill people if you don't have to do it. It's like, that just doesn't seem like the snow-capped summit of Christian charity. You know, I'd like to move further on than should we kill this innocent person? How about this innocent person? We get away with killing that innocent person, you know?
Well, I know, man. That's indicative of the level to which we've sunk.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're up against the break again, but we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Michael Litchens, and we'll be back with Jack Quirk and Christian Democracy Magazine right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Michael Litchens and Jack Quirk of Christian Democracy Magazine. Let's spend a little time on this last segment talking about Christian Democracy Magazine. If you're out there listening, you want to talk to Jack Quirk, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4, 1-573-4-BREAD. So let's talk about Christian Democracy Magazine a bit.
One of my favorite subjects.
All right.
It's, well, it was started just like 3 months before Pope Francis ascended to the papacy. I like to joke that we're responsible for Pope Francis, but obviously that's just a joke. But it is kind of fortuitous in a way that he came around at the time that he did from the standpoint of Christian Democracy and his mission, which is to try and look at Catholic social teaching in its raw form without really worrying about which political party will approve of our positions. That is, you know, I don't claim any magisterial authority for Christian Democracy itself, obviously, but we do try to make a sincere effort to at least not saying anything contrary to it. And that's our goal, to engage in commentary on political, social, and economic affairs in a Catholic light, in accordance with official magisterial Catholic teaching. Mm-hmm. That's our goal. And we hope that we succeed. Some people agree with us. Not everybody does, but there we are. We don't have exclusively Catholic writers. Amir Azarban, Matthew Cooper have written for us. They're both Orthodox. But you have our editor, Doran Hunter, Kirk Morrison, Julia Smucker, They're all Catholics and they're regular contributors. We have others that contribute from time to time. Avelina Ballastri has come along and written a couple articles for us recently. But and Father Mike Van Cleve is from time to time giving us his reflection. So it's been we've had some change in personnel over time in terms of people participating. Phil Ropp used to write for us. But but everybody understands that the basic mission is to try and look at the things that are talked about in the news in a Catholic light, in accordance with the magisterial light. That's our mission. That's our goal, and we hope that we succeed.
All right. Well, you know, that is a worthy goal, and it's refreshing to me to see periodicals out there that are actually trying to attack the questions that challenge us from the perspective of Catholic social teaching, and not, how should I put it, not strip mining Catholic teaching in order to accessorize a particular agenda.
Well, that's exactly right. And it always ends up being out of context when they do that, obviously.
Right.
Centesimus Annus is Pope John Paul II's, Pope John Paul II's encyclical that is given that treatment that you mentioned by the economic neoliberals. You'll find that that is often accomplished by quoting out of context and basically distorting the meaning of what the encyclical talks about.
Yeah, well, I mean, there was the famous what was it, Caritatis in Veritatis, in Red and Gold, the famous essay that George Weigel wrote, where he basically said, "Yeah, you can pay attention to this part of the encyclical because I like it, but just ignore that part because I'm sure that was just written by some functionary. It wasn't actually by the Pope."
I warned you about the dogs. I'm sorry about that.
Oh, it's the Dominicans. The Dominicans are here.
Yes. I think it's probably somebody delivering the paper, or it could be a leaf blowing in the wind. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, and I can hear your dog, too, so that's good.
Okay. I apologize.
It's all right. These things happen. Yes. So, arf.
Yes. So arf cool. is the word of the day every day around here.
Yeah. So, but anyway, I'm grateful that there are people who are trying to do that, people who are trying to maintain a consistent life ethic, people who are trying to be consistent when it comes to the church's whole teaching. I remember I talked to a guy one time online. I was trying to explain some point of Catholic teaching. And his response was, "Oh, I believe in Catholic social teaching. I believe in subsidiarity." And you realize that for him, that was it. That was all there was. The Catholic social teaching was subsidiarity.
Well, subsidiarity for that.
Right. And subsidiarity for him meant I get to keep all my money and the state can go to hell. And that's what subsidiarity meant, you know. And it was like, okay, so you don't actually know the first thing about Catholic social teaching, you know.
Well,
and
it's subsidiarity. Subsidiarity is often confused with federalism. It is not the same thing at all. Federalism has to do with jurisdiction. Subsidiarity has to do with competence.
Right.
Okay? So in other words, and in point of fact, when it came to it just so happens that I wrote an article on the 15th of February talking about subsidiary healthcare was the title of it. Mm-hmm. And basically this is obviously came out before the GOP plan to replace Obamacare came out. But I basically said that the dog had finally caught up with the car. I had to decide what to do with it now. And of course it's a conservative point of view that the federal government has no business in healthcare at all. Of course, run up against the annoyance provided by the Constitution that says that the Congress has power to lay and collect taxes and so forth to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But subsidiarity is often raised and says these things should be handled locally. But subsidiarity is often couched in jurisdictional type language. And that is, well, frankly, an error. It's not a jurisdictional question. It is a question of competence. The what it says is that the government should not do anything that can be handled privately or by lower organizations.
Right.
It doesn't say that even if the lower organizations or private organizations cannot handle it, that the federal government still should not because of some type of jurisdictional question.
Right.
And it also says that when even if things are being handled locally or by private entities or so on, the higher entity or the state should provide all necessary assistance in order to make that happen. So anybody who wants to say that the federal government can have no association with healthcare whatsoever and tries to base that upon subsidiarity, they're basically misrepresenting the principle.
Right. And it's a beloved misrepresentation, especially with libertarians. The idea that, let's drown the state in the bathtub. You know, right. There's a weird notion. I've run into this repeatedly, that somehow or other, if there is a state social safety net, then my ability to do something good for somebody out of my own private charity, somehow that's being threatened. And so and what comes out of it is this notion that what's more important is that a family be forced to go begging on the internet to keep from living in their car if their daughter has leukemia. It's more important that they be forced to do that so that I can feel good about myself for sticking $5 in a GoFundMe.
Yeah,
they get the help that they need, you know.
If somebody's really interested in helping the poor, the disadvantaged, the disabled, it really doesn't make any practical difference whether they're making their donation through private sources or through taxation.
Yeah, I know.
It doesn't make any practical difference. So
right.
I think that there's a little bit of a sleight of hand in those arguments.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Sure. It's like, you know, that weird thing of, okay, so what really matters here is not that the person whose daughter has leukemia gets the help that they need, but that you feel good about yourself. That's the important thing.
Well, you know, here you go. That's the entire approach to politics from that subset. And it's all about I want to try and keep my vote pure. And, you know, obviously the Republicans and the Democrats, there is no Catholic political party in the United States, really. And so they when if they want to vote Republican, they have to decide, well, that everything that I'm voting for is purely Catholic, because I don't want to feel like I'm being tainted by what I am doing in the voting booth. And
right.
So
too late.
So there you go. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a very strange thing to me. We just got a couple of seconds left. Michael, was there anything you wanted to... Oh, and there's the music. I'm sorry. We are done for the day, but I want to thank you for being on the show. The magazine is Christian Democracy Magazine. You can find it at www.christiandemocracymagazine.com. It's edited by Jack Quirk, a lot of fine writers working for it. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. My co-host today was Mr. Michael Litchens. And we will be back tomorrow with Rod Bennett. Until then, I want to thank you for listening in. And by the way, thank you, Danny Head, our producer. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye. Well, that
you still hear me?
Ended right on time. Okay.
Well, I'm sorry about the dogs.
Oh, no problem. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
No, it gives the show that raw, drop dead visceral authenticity that is so important to live radio.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Mark, for having me. And thank you, Michael, for having me and putting up with me. And
of course,
you gentlemen have a nice day. And
thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.